from KQED.
Support for the California Report comes from the Wesley Foundation, recognizing young social entrepreneurs through the Wesley Prize for Young Innovators of California. Digital Foundry, working with leading organizations to jumpstart digital innovation. More online at digitalfoundry.com. And Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected. On the web at theschmidt.org.
On today's California Report magazine, a political cartoonist who's chronicled the Obama presidency finds himself at a crossroads when he thinks about drawing comics of a President Trump.
I don't know if I want to stay in this world right now. It seems a little mean-spirited and ugly.
And we head to Mendocino County to meet a fisherman fighting a plague of spiny purple sea creatures.
It's much like trying to scratch the paint off a house with a pin. It's not going to be easy.
Plus, we meet a Punjabi peach farmer poet in Yuba City. And why do 180 people in Los Angeles want to look at coyote poop? I'm Sasha Coca, and this is the California Report magazine. With all eyes on a new president-elect, there's less attention on the guy about to leave the White House. But one LA comic artist is commemorating the Obama presidency with a new book through the eyes of the Obama's dog. Looking for America's Dog collects the best of Steven Weissman's whimsical and darkly funny online political comic strips. Here to tell us more is the California Report's LA Bureau Chief, Steven Cuevas.
It's about 36 hours after the presidential election. Steven Weissman's final comic strip of the election cycle is still sitting on his drafting board.
Yeah, all night the night before.
On the top, Hillary Clinton. The bottom, Donald Trump. Both feverishly tracking election night results on their phones.
Trump in his sort of secret underground lair and Hillary Clinton on a frozen wasteland, updating their feeds and getting results from states.
Weissman is among the stable of celebrated international comic artists affiliated with the publisher Fantagraphics. In Looking for America's Dog, he often depicts the president and his advisors as well-meaning but often clueless teenagers.
At the beginning, Vice President Biden is having a meeting at the White House and accidentally leaves the gate open, and Beau Obama, the president's first dog, runs out.
Isn't that the president's dog?
Oh, I left the gate open. The president is not happy, tromping through the snow looking for a lost dog.
It's my own stupid fault for leaving Joe Biden in charge.
Beau! Here, Beau!
If I don't find the dog, the girls are going to be very upset.
Beau! God damn you, Joe Biden!
We're going to find him. Those are actors bringing the comic to life in our studio, and a story that follows Beau Obama's around-the-world odyssey, including a stop in North Korea, where he encounters Kim Jong-un hanging with Dennis Rodman, as they did in real life.
Dennis Rodman respectfully presented a sincere gift to Marshal Kim Jong-un, expressing boundless reverence for him.
The dog engages in hot points all over the world, whether it was in Africa or the Korean Peninsula. Wherever there was something happening that seemed really interesting to me.
Meanwhile, first daughter Sasha develops a mysterious clairvoyance. She and her sister Malia track Beau's movements with her newfound powers.
There's that second sight. Malia's always asking her to kind of check up on celebrities. You know, well, what's happening with Chris Brown or something like that? She's like, no, I don't want to look at those guys. Sasha only wants to concentrate on the dog.
Have you really seen our dog, Sash?
I can see him now.
Where is he? What's he doing?
America's dog has been brought before the supreme leader.
Stop calling him that.
Now the leader is giving our dog a medal.
A medal? What for?
Oh my God.
What is it, Sasha?
We've lost him, Mal.
Finally, the girls, frustrated, travel to France to try and find him after he spotted at the offices of the Charlie Hebdo shooting.
By the time they'd stopped, at least 12 people were dead.
I don't like a lot of the mean-spirited things that are happening in this world, but for good comics, I think you can really explore them. And yeah, it gets really bloody and it gets ugly, and I'm sorry about that.
Now with the U.S. at a political crossroads, Weissman is at a creative crossroads. His online political strip may come to an end. He's just not very excited about cartooning Donald Trump.
Ow. He's more like a professional wrestler character.
I'm here to challenge you to a match in WrestleMania.
What? When I drew comics about President Obama or about Hillary, they seem like real grown-ups with, you know, real grown-up problems and kind of relate to someone who seems to have some conflict. I don't see conflict in Donald Trump. You know, you just sort of see this ego.
I'm taller than you. I'm better looking than you.
I don't know if I want to stay in this world right now. It seems a little mean-spirited and ugly. I don't think the world's going to end. It's just going to be kind of a meaner place for the next few years.
Near the start of Looking for America's Dog, a single-page comic breaks up the action, inspired by the Little House on the Prairie books. It's a pastoral scene in a cabin by a warm hearth, an oasis of calm in the middle of a political world that's spinning off its axis. Weissman says he'd like to devote more time to work like that, that focuses on simple qualities like faith and kindness. For the California Report, I'm Stephen Cuevas in Los Angeles.
And now we bring you another in our series of letters to the next president from California teens. This one from a student named Maida at Santa Clara High School.
To your future president, in one of the world's wealthiest countries, poverty is a major issue. The USA has a population of 318.9 million as of 2014, according to the United States Census Bureau. People in poverty do not have the ability to meet their basic needs. Due to their limited income, many suffer from lack of food. While most Americans have encountered someone suffering from hunger and poverty in the United States, few of us may have actually realized it. The face of hunger and poverty in the United States is quite different from the images we often see in developing nations. So please, future president, improve work incentives for the poor so they can provide wealth for themselves and their families. Improve the quality of education for poor children and present a wider range of opportunities. We all need your help to make our dreams a reality. Thank you, Maida.
We'll bring you more letters to the next president from California youth between now and the inauguration. You can read or listen to them on our website, californiareport.org. And now we've got a story about a man who's invented a kind of underwater vacuum cleaner to deal with a very big problem. He's a fisherman in Mendocino County, and he's seen his livelihood threatened by disappearing kelp forests. He took the California Report's Eli Wirtschafter out on a boat to see the damage.
Well, there you go.
John Holcomb is a fisherman with the leathery skin of a man who spends a lot of time out on this boat.
When we leave the harbor, we'll be entering fog, so I'll turn the radar on.
For 42 years, Holcomb has made his living as a diver. He sells red urchins. Their buttery insides turn into uni in Japanese restaurants. Holcomb takes me to a peaceful cove near the town of Mendocino, where he used to dive for urchins.
This was solid kelp when we first came here in the mid-80s. Solid kelp outside over toward the rocks there. This was a complete mat you couldn't swim through.
Now he squints across the water and sees something very different.
Well, it's devoid of kelp. It's like a lake.
That's bad for fishermen like Holcomb because urchins feed on kelp. In the last 2 years, the local red urchin harvest has plummeted by 90%.
Without kelp, you'll lose all your shell fishery. You'll lose the abalone fishery. You'll lose the urchin fishery.
The kelp was devoured by a different kind of urchin, purple urchins. They're smaller, less meaty, not worth fishing for. And they're voracious eaters of kelp.
Nothing can survive their appetite. And they just keep breeding, and there's more and more of them each year.
So now, Holcomb and a few other local divers are trying to revive the ecosystem by getting rid of purple urchins. And to do that, they're teaming up with a group that sometimes makes divers a little prickly, the agency that regulates how much they can fish.
I'm Dr. Cynthia Catton. I work for the California Department of Fish and Wildlife.
Catton is a marine biologist who fell in love with the kelp forest ecosystem. The varieties of shellfish, the tall, multicolored kelp, and the young fish that shelter in its stalks.
In 2015, when we went out to do our subtitle surveys, we saw drastically changed system.
The researchers found a seafloor carpeted with purple urchins. Catton says this transformation started when a gruesome wasting disease nearly wiped out local sea stars. They were the urchins' main predator. So when the sea stars died, urchins went on a kelp-eating rampage.
I have a friend who calls them the goats of the sea. They form these feeding fronts and they just munch all the way through everywhere they're walking.
Another problem, kelp need cold water. But for the last 2 years, the northern Pacific Ocean has been unusually warm, an effect that hasn't been explained by global warming alone. And then last year's El Nino made the water even warmer. Catton's team saw the kelp forests between the Bay Area and Oregon shrink by 93%.
We refer to it as the perfect storm. The kelp forest has just kind of gotten it from all sides.
So this spring, Catton met up with a group of local divers, including John Holcomb. And they came up with an experiment to remove purple urchins at a few test sites on the coast. Back on his boat near Mendocino, Holcomb shows me the device he's invented to suck up huge loads of urchins at a time. He slaps together 10-foot-long pieces of fiberglass tubing to make a sort of underwater vacuum cleaner.
I didn't get carried away here on the aesthetics of this.
Holcomb puts on his scuba gear and connects the tube to an air pump on deck. Then he dives down into the water with the device. I couldn't go underwater to watch, but he's made videos where you can see and hear what he does next. The video shows the seafloor about 30 feet under. It looks like a minefield of spiky purple creatures. Holcomb uses a little metal rake to scrape the urchins off the rocks into a tube, which sucks them into a huge net. On the day I'm with him, it takes him almost 2 hours to clear off an area smaller than a tennis court. He finally comes up and his net is packed with thousands of purple urchins with wiggly spines.
They're still moving, aren't they?
Oh yeah, they're alive and they'll stay alive for 2 or 3 days.
We head back to a dock in Fort Bragg where Cynthia Catton, the fish and wildlife biologist, has brought a bunch of local volunteers to count and measure the urchins.
We'll go ahead and we'll write down your observations, your estimates, so the amount of area that you guys covered and the amount of time it took you.
If Catton wants to expand the project, she'll need to know exactly what it takes to clear an area of urchins and whether the effort actually helps the kelp forest grow back.
It's much like trying to scratch the paint off a house with a pin. It's not going to be easy.
But there is one hopeful sign. Scientists have recently found a surprising number of baby sea stars up and down the coast. Remember, sea stars eat urchins. If they survive into adulthood without melting away from the wasting disease, they could help restore the natural balance of the kelp forest. For the California Report, I'm Eli Wirtschafter.
The first float in the Nagar Kirtan parade carries the religious text at the heart of this holiday. The huge crowd floods these small streets. Helicopters drop rose petals on the crowd, and men from various Sikh motorcycle clubs show off their Harleys. People come from far and wide.
I'm from New Jersey.
From Canada.
From the UK.
From Dallas, Texas.
I live in Manteca, California.
That last voice you hear is Happy Singh.
Little bit Timor.
Who's offering tea to passersby. The parade starts and ends at the Tierra Buena Gurdwara, or Sikh House of Worship, a gleaming blue and white structure that looks like it's rising out of the orchards surrounding it. People wait in long lines for food.
This is chole. It's a type of curry that's made in Punjab. This has spinach, cabbage, and curry.
The tea, the multiple tents serving food, they're part of the tradition of langar, the Sikh communal kitchen.
Anytime any person comes to our temple, we will try to accommodate him for night sleep and for free food.
That's community elder Mohinder Singh Gag. He wears a broad smile and a burgundy turban. The size of this crowd is astounding, especially given that when Gog first arrived in the early 60s, just a few Punjabi families lived here. He came, like other Sikhs, for farming. At 86, he still farms on his property in Live Oak, just outside Yuba City. Today, he's overseeing the kiwi harvest, but for most of his life here, Gog grew peaches.
Colder nights, when temperature dropped, silence prevailed,
Here's where I tell you that, in addition to being a farmer, Mohinder Gog's a bit of a poet with a number of books published in Punjabi.
If my trees survive the frosty night, I will forget all the pain. I'm a peach farmer.
In the early 1900s, the impacts of famine and British colonialism forced thousands of Punjabis out of their homeland. Many found their way to the Sacramento Valley with a familiar climate and location at the nexus of many rivers.
This area is very close to the Punjab.
But within years, Indians and other Asians were barred from owning land and then from immigrating to the U.S. Restrictions loosened by the 60s when Gog came. He remembers being one of a few men in the area wearing a turban.
It helped me a whole lot, the turban.
I did a double take when he said this. After 9/11, and more recently after the shootings in San Bernardino, hate crimes against Sikhs ballooned. Some attackers mistook Sikhs for Muslims. Others simply targeted them for being different, other. But Gog says his turban has opened doors.
It helped me a whole lot because I was a source of attraction wherever I go.
Now, I approached Gog every way I could with questions about isolation and discrimination, but he insisted.
In this community, you know, I haven't felt that somebody discriminated me.
And he dove into civic life here, even becoming a California delegate for the Democratic Party. Connecting with neighbors is a big reason the Sikh community started this public Nagar Kirtan celebration 37 years ago.
There's more recognition that we are a community living here. And then since then, it's been going on bigger and bigger every year.
An opportunity for Sikhs to celebrate their own holiday and bring others in too. For the California Report, I'm Lisa Morehouse in Yuba City.
And now let's dip back into politics and the arts with some music. Bassist Mark Dresser's latest work, Sedimental You, has a song that references Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin written before the election. Here to tell us about that and the debut album of drummer Matt Mayhall are the California Report's Susie Racho and our jazz critic Andrew Gilbert. They join us every month to talk about the latest from jazz musicians here in the Golden State.
That is bassist Mark Dresser from his latest album, Sedimental You. And if you're a big jazz fan, you know that he's a well-known player who's been on the cutting edge of the genre for years. He's collaborated with fellow boundary pushers like John Zorn, Anthony Braxton, Bob Ostertag. What else should people know about him, Andy?
Well, you know, Mark, he sort of works at these overlapping junctions between new music and free improv and jazz. Wonderful composer, and he's been on faculty at UC San Diego since 2004.
Tell me a little bit about this record. What's different about it?
His last few albums, he was sort of concentrating on solo recitals and duo projects. This, he's sort of getting back into larger ensemble. It's a seven-piece group, the Mark Dresser Seven. There's also seven compositions on the album. And he's sort of combining these East Coast connections, because he spent a lot of time in New York, with West Coast musicians. And you've got these amazing veteran players, Marty Ehrlich on clarinet, Nicole Mitchell on flute, with some younger players, Joshua White, a real interesting rising pianist from San Diego, and musician, I believe he's making his recording debut, a violinist, David Morales Boroff, who I think we're going to hear a lot more from.
And I noticed this record, Sedimental You, it seems to have a couple of themes going. You know, politics is one. The first song we heard was actually called Hobby Lobby Horse, they've been in the news. But their song's also devoted to fellow musicians, right?
Yeah, there's sort of two really prominent threads to this. There is this sort of Dresser responding to current events. There's a piece, Trumpin' Putin Stupin', which...
Pre-election
by, you know, recorded probably a year before the election or so. And yet it's got this phantasmagoric, carnivalesque feel where you really feel like, wow, he saw something coming.
Thank you.
then there's these beautiful tributes to other musicians. There's a piece for the great trombonist Roswell Rudd. And then I thought, let's listen to a lovely, it's sort of just a theme. There's not even really improvisation on it. A piece for Daniel Jackson, who died a few years ago. He was sort of a bebop icon, tenor saxophonist of San Diego.
That's Mark Dresser, and his album is called Sentimental You. Our next album is the debut of incredibly busy and versatile Los Angeles drummer Matt Mahal. That's Dum Dum from Matt Mahal's Tropes. He's a drummer from LA who's played in a lot of interesting projects, just like Mark Dresser. But he's played in The Both, which features Amy Mann and Ted Leo. He was in Fred Armisen's soft rock band on Documentary Now. And, you know, but he's a jazzer. He's also played with the late Charlie Hayden.
Yeah, that's an interesting connection because that was sort of through Charlie's son, Josh Hayden, through the band Spain. And I believe it was Charlie Hayden's last recording, but it was through the band Spain.
This is the first album from Matt Mahal where he's a leader. Who else is on this record?
There's some fantastic players. I mean, for me, the guitarist Jeff Parker, who's sort of everywhere these days and has his own great album out, The New Breed. And then there's also the bassist Paul Bryan, who produced the album too. So I thought we'd listen to his tune, The Includer, which really sort of captures the way he builds textures and just sort of lets the music unfold.
That's Matt Mahal. His debut album is called Tropes. And I know you wanted to mention another experimental artist that we lost recently.
We've lost so many, it seems like. But Pauline Oliveros was such an important figure in the world, but particularly in California. She was one of the founders of the San Francisco Tape Music Center. She taught for years at Mills. She just had such a big influence on so many players, and her deep listening sort of theory and practice, kind of the Zen approach to letting music unfold. I just thought it was important to note her passing.
Andy has more on the releases from Mark Dresser and Matt Mahal at californiareport.org. Thanks so much, Andy.
Good to talk to you, Susie.
Andrew Gilbert is the California Report's jazz and world music critic.
And we close our show today in Los Angeles, where coyotes roam the streets of densely populated neighborhoods. Biologists have been wondering what these urban canines eat to survive in this city. So dozens of volunteers are scouring the streets for coyote droppings. From KCRW in Los Angeles, Avishai Artsy has the scoop.
There are those of us who think coyotes are a menace to society. They lie in wait until we take our eyes off our cats and small dogs, then they strike. Others are fans of these wily predators, like Melanie Simmons.
And they actually do a tremendous job to keep the numbers of rodents in check.
It's surprising to hear this from a woman who keeps chickens in her backyard and who's lost some of those chickens to coyotes.
Chickens are delicious to coyotes, and they've earned their trickster name, as far as I can say from my own experience.
Simmons is among a cadre of Angelenos who jumped at the chance to scavenge the city for coyote poop as part of a National Park Service study on the diet of coyotes. Volunteers huddle around a table to look at bowls of dried poop from bobcats and coyotes.
So what I would do if I saw this on the trail is I would break it in half.
Okay,
so I'm
gonna
do
see
that.
A little twist.
Binta Wold helps run the National Park Service's Urban Coyote Project.
So that's pretty much entirely fur.
Okay.
So I would collect that. Okay.
The project started this summer, and so far, here's what they're finding in the coyote poop.
We've got rabbit and different species of mice and different species of rats and pocket gopher, which has been really common.
Date palm seeds, and then I've found some small bones, some feathers. A lot of hair. I've definitely found a few cat claws, unfortunately. Plastic, a lot of thread, oddly. Some aluminum foil, some corn that wasn't digested.
National Park Service ecologist Justin Brown says coyotes will get into people's trash.
Now, have you gotten a sense that people are feeding coyotes?
So I've definitely seen people actively feeding coyotes and other wildlife, putting either food from their lunch out in an area, and you can see the coyotes keep coming back. But then also people are putting plates of dog food out as well.
Actively feeding wildlife is illegal, and animal control is trying to crack down. Brown's concerned feeding coyotes will make them more likely to approach people and possibly bite them. Brown says a lot of people are afraid of coyotes, and he was surprised by the level of public interest in the project. He received 180 applications and picked 30 lucky volunteers to gather poop. One of them, Mary D. Donnan, can hear the coyotes howling near her house at night, and some neighbors have lost cats.
A very small percentage of coyotes' diets is cat or pet. So the random cat that goes missing, everybody wants to blame the poor coyote, and that's not fair. So I think the more we know about them, the more we might appreciate them as part of our urban environment and our wildlife.
The Park Service hopes the study will guide policy about how to coexist with coyotes. Volunteers will spend the next year and a half gathering scat all over LA and dissecting it. The coyote survey is expected to wrap up by the end of 2018. For the California Report, I'm Avishai Artsy in Los Angeles.
And that's the California Report magazine, a production of KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. Our director is Susie Racho. Howard Gelman was behind the board today, and we had additional engineering from Katie McMurrin. Our online producer is David Marks. The California Report's senior editor is Victoria Maulion. Our editorial staff includes Lacey Jane Roberts, Pat Flynn, Ingrid Becker, Ethan Lindsay, and Holly Kernan. I'm Sasha Coca. Thanks for listening. This is the California Report magazine.
California Foodways is made possible with support from Cal Humanities, a nonprofit partner of the NEH. Visit www.calhum.org. Support for the California Report comes from the California Endowment, working to achieve health and justice for all. Learn more at calendow.org. The James Irvine Foundation, expanding economic and political opportunity for Californians who are working but struggling with poverty. More at irvine.org. And Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected. On the web at theschmidt.org.